Accession number 18222, Elisa Shapiro, reel 3, followed after a pause by reel 4.
Elisa Shapiro, reel 3. Yes, do you remember, you arrived in Britain just before the outbreak of war. Do you remember the day war broke out?
Yes, I do indeed. I remember we were in the living room and the radio was on and Chamberlain made his speech. And of course, I didn't understand. I didn't speak one word of English at that time. And my parents knew a little. Not much more, but they must have understood the application because they went white. And then the silence went. And then, for some strange reason, we already had gas masks. I think they must have been handed out before. And we all went down to the shelter. There was a basin in the house, and there were, I think, 6 flats in the block, and we were expected to go into the shelter. I don't know. And somebody said something about mattresses. And I didn't know what a mattress was, but I knew the word maîtresse, which is mistress in French. And somebody said everybody has to bring their mattress down. And I thought everybody had to bring their mistress. Anyway, I remember sitting in the shelter, and we all had our gas masks on. Must have been everybody from the house, so it can't have been just us. But that's, I remember that, and then after a while we took them off again, we didn't think. That was the actual day when that man Chamberlain, who we thought at the time had come to bring peace in our time, had to face the worst, really. Because strangely enough, I remember the day when he came to Munich, when I was still at school. And it was the day, as I mentioned before, on which my sister was getting married. Now, my sister was getting married in London, and I wasn't allowed to go to the wedding. I wasn't allowed to go to the wedding because everybody thought war would break out. So the wedding, which was going to be a nice, happy event, wasn't such a happy event, I gather. It was a rather rushed and sad event because they didn't want to leave the same night. But fact remains, everybody went to London except me, and I went to school. And then our whole school was called out, and we were all given little swastika flags, paper flags, and we marched to the station to receive Chamberlain. And there was this sea of little flags waving, you know, and 3 cars. Hitler was in the first car, as usual. Starts, and then there was a car with Chamberlain, and then there was a car with Balladier, and Mussolini, I think, was there as well, but I wouldn't swear to it. But I do remember Balladier and Chamberlain, and this roaring welcome, you know, and gave a day of school, which was bliss. You know, on a completely different tack, my parents were away. And this was 29th of September, which is the time of Oktoberfest. I don't know whether that means anything to you. Oktoberfest in Munich is the big beer festival, which no nice Jewish child is ever allowed to go on its own. But my parents were here. So I and my girlfriend, we went up to the Oktoberfest. And we went on the big dipper, we went on the lot, you see, because everything is there to control us. So it wasn't really a very ominous thing, what we were going to say. It was somehow unaware. I knew what was happening, and I didn't know what was happening. And then I came home, and late at night I was already in bed. My sister and her new husband came, and she woke me up, and she gave me a kiss, and she said goodbye. And then it was a Thursday. So that's genuine. And then to a man, he had to make this speech, which can't be easy for him. And the other stuff. And
so what was life like for you, you know, coming to England from France and living with your parents in this flat? You know, can you remember those days?
Well, again, I was, well, we weren't alone. There was the sister of my brother-in-law, but, you know, the chap who married my sister, who's now in Israel, and she had been given a permit as a domestic. So she spent all her free time with us. And one of my father's brothers had got out as well, and he lived with us. So it was a very crowded flat.
Had your father got a job, you know, was he doing anything?
No, he wasn't. I think slowly, I think he had permission to work, but he had to find, you know, he didn't know how to start. Eventually, he did a little bit of dealing from home. I remember going to Sotheby's with him once in a while. And he then also did some work for Scotland Yard, identifying forgeries. But that was much later then. And I was sent to school, nightmare, yet again, without language. And back to being a village idiot. And I was sent to Clark's College in Sheepcot Hill, which was a lousy school to send me to, but they didn't know anything, you see, they didn't know anything about our school system. And that was a mixed class, boys and girls. And I really became a terrible figure of fire. It was horrible, it really was horrible. If you can't speak a language, you do feel very lost.
Yes, and I was wondering also, you know, the fact that you came from Germany, and Britain was then at war with Germany, whether you had any sort of anti-German...
Yes, there was a lot of anti-German feelings. And to some we were German, and to others we were refugees, and whatever we were, we didn't belong.
Was there any support from the a Jewish community in London, you know, in Cricklewood?
Not that I remember, quite honestly, but there may have been for my parents. I know that there was a synagogue round the corner in Warm Lane, and we did go to the synagogue occasionally, but it wasn't... I mean, I personally don't remember any associations, really. And I had no friends there at all. Certainly not until I spoke English.
How soon was that, do you think? How quickly did you pick it up?
Fairly quickly. I'm fairly good at languages. I mean, you know, you have to. You have a secret swim. And I have another secret. I mean, you know, that's when the survival instinct, I think, comes in useful. You do get good at this. because there was some really horrible incidents. I remember an exam we had at school, a French exam. French, of course, I'm fluent by then. And in Germany, you know, every country has its own ethos. In Germany, if you didn't help each other during exams, cheating, we would pass messages stuck in our shoes, you know, to your neighbour in France. Whereas in England, cheating is bad form. You don't do it. And we had a French exam, and the girl next to me didn't know her French. So I did it for her, which to me seemed a natural thing to do. But of course it wasn't. So There is another retouching set. And I remember, you know, we had to and these stupid little incidents that stick in your mind. We had to do something about translating again from French. A man, il avait quelque chose au-dessus de sa poitrine. He had a shawl across his bust, yes. And I didn't know the bust, and I wrote, he wrapped the shawl across his breast, and the teacher, and this was a mixed class, and he stood up and he said, in England, men have chests. And there was all this tittering going on. Anyway, I learned English. But we didn't stay very long because when the Blitz started, we were evacuated.
With the school, with Clark's College?
Because the flat got damaged. And we went to Reading, to Caversham to be precise. And then I went on strike. Nothing on earth would get me back to school. I will never go through that again. So effectively, my education stopped at 11. So I'm really highly educated, as you would say, in my school. And then we lived in Reading.
What did you do with yourself if you didn't go to school?
I went to secretarial college. And I learned shorthand typing. And when I was 14, I got a job at John Lewis. It wasn't called John Lewis, it was called the John Lewis in Reading. And I became a shorthand typist. And then we came back to London. And we were in London for the Doodlebugs. We lived in Golden Terrace and in the flat. And I considered myself a working woman. I got a job as a shorthand typist. Worked for a theatrical agency. And then, well, I don't know what you want to know.
Your experience of the V1s and V2s, you know, were you directly affected by them?
Our flat wasn't hit, but yes. I remember once in my lunchtime being in a restaurant in Brewer Street because I worked just off Piccadilly and I had my lunch sometimes in the little sort of cafe, and suddenly the scene came down, you know, and you remember the noises, that everybody remembers the noises when the noise stops. That's when something falls, yes. In fact, we were here during the Blitz, a large time of the Blitz also. We came back because I remember we slept in the underground. We slept in the underground, which was cottage. And we would get up like everybody else ready at dawn, you know, and we would see the East End burning and the sky would be red. It was a sad time, and it was a wonderful time because there was this incredible spirit, which always comes out in crisis.
Were you feeling then more at home?
Yes.
You know, once you started...
My English was okay.
Mm-hmm. How about, you know, your working in John Lewis and then when you came back to London?
Those were good times.
Were they?
They were fine. They really were. And, you know, my father, you asked me before what happened to him after Kristallnacht. He really had very badly affected. He had also apparently been shell-shocked during the First War. And so he, you know, the bombs were terrifying to him. And I remember a time when my sister and I were alone in London because we refused to go back to Reading. We had become very independent by then, really. And very, I mean, I became an adult, really, at the age of 12. And I wasn't going to go back. I'd had enough of this, you know, carrying my suitcase from one place to another, and I was quite prepared to be here in the Blitz, but we obviously came back too early. So that for quite a while, my parents were in Reading, and we were here. How they manage to do that, don't ask me. And again, you know, psychology not heard of. I don't know what it was about, but we were here. And my sister and I slept in Swiss Cottage Underground. But that was okay. I mean, we were just doing what everybody else was doing as well. And then I became involved in Habonim, which is the Zionist Youth Movement. And I was very active. And I started to work with the Jewish Agency. And in fact, I had to give a talk a couple of days ago about my experiences then. I remember the night of the 29th of November, when the votes came back from the United Nations. I was by then working, I was no longer just a structural therapist, I was going to be a journalist. And I worked already as a junior reporter, I suppose, for what was then called PALCO, Palestine Correspondence Agency. And I would have to cover the Palestine debates in the House of Commons and the House of Lords and take down Begin's speeches. So on the night of the 29th of November, I was with the teleprinter at 77 Great Russell Street when the votes were coming through the first three were and then Bolivia was the first, yes, euphoria when the votes came through. And then on the 8th of August, 48, I was in and I first worked with the press corps. And I was then, I just call myself a journalist, you know, a bit of a cheeky thing to make. I was a journalist, and I worked with the Foreign Press Corps, and it was really exciting. It was a war, but certainly I personally had no sense of fear at all then, and didn't come into it. Because really, it's a strange, I don't know whether I can describe that time to you. When somehow your own identity melds into the collective, and the collective is so much more important than the individual self, and when really your sense of purpose is entirely at last we will no longer be passive victims, and we will have a country of our own, and that was just unbelievably, you know, inspiring, really, was the word. That was a wonderful, wonderful time of cooperation and endurance. Then nobody could have cared less, and unheard of hospitality and openness and trust. And it was really brought out in a way like the Blitz, yes, only perhaps more intense, because whoever was there knew why. You know, that this was about survival. So I was there during the war with the Foreign Press. It was very exciting. I remember this is relevant. Yes. Again, personal incidents, stupid incidents. The first Yom Kippur was our day of journey. It was a it was an incredible Yom Kippur, but so important, yes, a day of thanksgiving and the day of atonement for all the grief that had been inflicted on our opponents. And yet, yeah, I was in my sort of, I was so arrogant that I was 21 and I decided religion wasn't for me. I'd grown all that stuff. And the United Press correspondent asked me out for lunch. And we went to the only restaurant which was open because there was all the Foreign Press was there. So I went there and I was the only Jewish person there. And I felt so ashamed. I fasted ever since.
Yes, I wonder No, this involves, of course, the survivors of the Holocaust, doesn't it? The people who'd been in the camps. Do you remember, you know, during the war, were you getting any news or, you know, particularly when you joined the Zionist organisation, of what was happening in Europe, you know, the concentration and death camps? Can you remember when, you know, about what stage in the war you were getting that?
Well, on a personal level, we got one or two postcards still from my father's sister and from cousins that had been left behind from concentration camps, and they were always these stilted messages from them. But they were as I worked in the Jewish agency in the political department, we did get news there, yes. And I remember when, what was his name, Siegelbaum, that was the memorial for him last Sunday, who had come out and brought information nobody believed him when he committed his suicide. And I mean, I remember that time being, but this was already after the war, when I was at the agency. You were asking me during the war. During the war, I was only aware of what everybody was aware. Slowly, slowly, rumors came out, yes, and these postcards came out, and one began to appear, yes, but without substantiated evidence until 1945.
Yes, the Jewish agency, when was that founded? Do you have any idea at what stage that was formed?
I'm not sure. I'm now speculating because I haven't done my homework. It must have been after the First Zionist Congress, in the 30s, I would have thought.
But was it, you know, enlarged at this time in World War II?
I joined it. It was a crazy government in exile. And the Leon was here, and Charette was here, and the Colette was here, and Ivan was here. It was a very dynamic time, and there was a lot of political negotiation going on. And I had a wonderful job. I mean, it was really very exciting to be at the hub of things like that.
Yes, you would have met these people. Yes. Could you tell me something? did you say Ben Gurion was here?
Mm.
Yes. What was he like?
He was a very fiery little man. I liked him. I mean, we all looked on him with awe, you know. He was Ben Gurion, and I was a secretary or a junior reporter. But I remember him having flu once, and I was sent over to look after him. Because Paula, his wife, was away. And we sort of took turns looking after him.
Where did they stay?
Oh, God, I can't remember.
They were in London, then, were they?
Mm-hmm.
And Abba Ivan
was in a flat, and I don't remember.
But you were aware that of their status, were you? Their stature.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And this relationship between them, particularly the Labour government, you know, in 1945,
and the
British Labour government, yes, Ernest Bevin. You know, did you get any feeling of how he was regarded, Ernest Bevin, by the Jewish agency?
I remember that I had, by that, you know, during the war, I had become very political, very socialist, and I remember distributing pamphlets for the Labour Party, and, you know, and then we actually won. And please note that I say we, yes, I felt at that stage very identified. And very proud that I was allowed to be, you know, this was very much my country of, I was incredibly, and still am actually, very, very grateful to England. I mean, I love England very much. So when Labour came in, it was a moment of, it was wonderful. And then, of course, we got Bevin, and we were always back to square one. I don't know why he hated us so much, but he was...
Do you really think that was the case? That
it was probably political. Look, the Arabs are powerful, the Arabs have the oil. The oil is always the answer. We were a few hundred thousand refugees, who cares in the game of politics? And it was not a British advantage. I mean, looking back, I can understand that. But when you are part of it, of course, then you don't understand. You still understand it, perhaps, but you have to fight it.
Yes. Would you have been also involved, you know, particularly the news of what was happening in this sort of illegal immigration at this time?
Yes, I was going to go illegally. I had my passage booked, as it were. I remember going to Paris with Teddy Pollock, who used to be the mayor of Jerusalem. And Teddy helped me to, you know, you have to go through all those interviews and things. I was going to go illegally. And then I came back and I told my parents, and I was all about to not go. And my mother said, I'm going to commit suicide and you can't go. So anyway, I decided I had to wait until I was 21. When I was 21, I went. But by then it was 48, and I didn't have to go either anymore. Mm-hmm.
What was that well organised? I think it was called The Flight, wasn't it?
Which was, Bet is the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It was the second Aliyah. Actually, second Aliyah means something else. It means the first, second wave of immigration which came over at the turn of the century, namely from Russia. Most of the kibbutzim were formed by second Aliyah people. So I think I'm wrong in translating it as the second Aliyah, but Aliyah number B. It was organised.
Yes, where was it organised from? Have you any idea?
I don't know that I should be telling you. it was all over the place, you know, wherever there was a DP camp, we tried to get them out. Largely from Trieste. I think Trieste was one of the main points.
The Jewish Brigade, were they involved in this?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Not, I mean, I wouldn't know. But I don't think so. I don't think they could have been. I think their loyalties wouldn't have been jeopardized like that. I don't think we would have been able to afford to involve them, really, because they would be very poor. Because don't forget that everybody who was in the Jewish Brigade served as a very loyal soldier. They fought to get a Jewish Brigade, if you remember. And they were, you know, that it was a matter of pride to fight against Hitler. So they wouldn't have done anything to undermine the government of the time. So, to the best of my knowledge,
how about
there were a lot of people from Palestine who were involved.
When the boatloads of survivors were turned back by the Royal Navy. What was the reaction in the Jewish agency to this? You know, was there a lot of lobbying of Parliament? Were you involved in that at all?
A lot of lobbying. And we had a lot of friends. I remember Richard Cosman, for example, being a great support. We had support as well. But Bevin was Foreign Minister. But we had support. And there was shock, real shock, a lack of comprehension also. You know, it's always that the perception when you are subjectively involved is so different to the perception of when you are on the outside. and everybody had their own agenda. But we couldn't understand how they could come back. You know, people who had really been, and by then all the evidence was out, and everybody knew what these people, never mind what they'd gone through, what they looked like. They had become subhuman, yes, they were like animals coming out of cages, groping, you know, for a new little bit of life. We just couldn't understand why there was just no mercy, no awareness of humanity.